From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mock Report. It's the ninth day of April 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And then later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, University of Illinois Extension is restructuring. The agency will close some offices, combine others, and reduce personnel in the process. I discussed the details of the plan with Gary Beaumont earlier today. You'll hear that unedited interview. And then, in the second half hour of our program, on some of these radio stations, and of course online at willag.org, we'll explore how NAS collects data, and this weekend's VetMed Open House. You're invited to the open house and to stay with us for this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
In Chicago, now on this Friday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at 465 and three quarters, 3.5 cents lower. July at 479 and a quarter, down 3 1/4. And September futures, 496 and a half, down 3 1/4. In Kansas City, May hard red at 483 and a half, 2 cents lower. The harvest month, July at 494 and a quarter, down 2 cents. Back in Chicago, for the corn pit, nearby May futures, 2.5 lower, 345 and three quarters is settlement price. July at 357 and a quarter, down 2 1/4, and September at 367 and three quarters, 2 1/4 lower. December corn futures at 378 and three quarters, down 2.5 cents. Soy complex nearby May beans up 5 3/4, $9.52 1/4 the settlement price. July 962 up 6, August at 957 and a quarter, 4 1/4 higher, in September futures 943 1/4 up 1 1/4. November bean futures at 936 1/2, down a penny today. May bean meal at 265.30 up $2.70. May soybean oil at $40.04 up 12 cents. April live cattle futures $99.65, 30 cents higher. The April feeder cattle at 114.52 1/2 up $1.65 for the day. The May futures there at 115.37 1/2, up $1.32 1/2. April lean hogs were 45 lower at 76.22 1/2. The May, on the other hand, were up 95 at 83.87 1/2. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $84.89 a barrel, down a nickel for the afternoon, rather down 50 cents for the afternoon. May ethanol at $1.53 7/10, unchanged. June down just about 6/10 of a cent at $1.55 4/10. Natural gas at $4.72 of a cent, up 16 3/10. Heating oil down 3/10 of a cent at $2.22 4/10. And the gold futures now at $1,161.10 a cent. Settlement price up $8.90. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,967 is 40 points 6 higher, and the U.S. dollar at 81.09 is down 0.44. The CRB index for the day, currently trading the Commodity Research Bureau index at 276.13, 0.88 higher, and the Goldman Sachs at 541.89. is up 1/16 on the afternoon. Here's a quick look at some of the weather highlights for the day. A warming trend will bring improving conditions to most of Illinois and Indiana through the middle of next week. A storm system will move across the upper Midwest on Sunday. Northern Illinois could get a few showers and thunderstorms as the storms pass, but the impact, they say, will be limited. Soil moisture will limit field work in southern Illinois and southwestern Indiana, but forecasts for dry and warm weather conditions over the next week to 10 days will allow for rapid improvement. Field work in western Illinois will advance with only a slight chance of a brief interruption, that toward the middle of next week. And while no widespread flooding will occur, a few waterways, mainly in western Illinois, will remain in minor flood stage. The dry forecast in the next week will also benefit the high water situation between the Illinois and the Mississippi rivers. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. And we talk with state climatologist Jim Angel.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's a Friday afternoon. Time now to check in on the agricultural futures markets. And like yesterday, Mike Zuzolo joins us to take a look at what happened in Chicago. But he probably wants to start with what happened in Washington, D.C. and the USDA NASS WASD reports this morning. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it, Mike.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it, too. Yeah, we came out with a 950 million bushel wheat ending stocks number. That was probably the most bullish or surprising thing on the trade from the USDA. We had exports that were increased. I think that's probably been 6 or 7 months since we've seen wheat exports increase, so that's certainly something to take note of. Corn ending stocks remained at about 1.9 billion, up about 100 million bushels from last month. Lower feed and residual was the major cause for that, and soybeans came in unchanged at 190 million bushels. Trade forecast was probably expecting a little bit more than that. In fact, the trade estimates, when they came out on Dow Jones, about two-thirds of the 18 analysts out there were looking at 200 million or higher. So that was a little bit of a friendly surprise as well for the U.S. numbers. World stocks went up in the coarse grains and in the oil seeds, while they went down a little bit in the wheat.
Yeah, so it should have been a very good day probably for the wheat, and it was, at least for a while, and then they faded at the end of the day.
Yeah, technicals took over. There was no follow-through short covering by the commodity trading funds. We tried to take out the Wednesday's weekly high just under 479, 480 level, and failed to do that, and it seemed like from then on out it was hard for wheat to get any traction at all, even in light of a slipping dollar throughout the rest of the session. So, yeah, wheat was probably the most disappointing from a standpoint of the reaction by the trade to the report and then what kind of sustainability and price gains it was able to have through the close.
Can you combine what we saw in the wheat and the bigger exports and what you're seeing in corn and give us an idea of where you think those two markets are headed as we go into the planting season for corn and soybeans?
I think that I could put wheat back as the leader to the upside for the corn, Todd, and I think that's because we saw this week that the global demand is improving. We saw from USDA's report that they see exports for our wheat improving. That surprise carryover cut, I think, is something that the trade will go away this weekend and take a look at further. World stocks are still burdensome, so we're not looking at any type of, you know, sharply higher rally unless we get some type of new news out of China and their currency or their drought situation. The other thing I noted was the wheat-corn spread is giving a technical buy signal. In other words, the wheat looks to be a buy compared to the corn on a lead-month basis. That makes sense from a standpoint of how much the wheat's dropped and brought the corn down. It also makes sense from a seasonal standpoint that if we do open up the corn planting window, then maybe the corn faces more pressure from a seasonal standpoint than the wheat would. So I think looking at it medium term, the wheat would be back as the leader to the upside for the corn for me. I think maybe to add to that is the trade as far as what they've priced in. I think maybe the wheat and the corn will face less export competition as the marketing year goes forward, and the trade has already priced in plenty of negativity there, whereas the beans, I suspect that we're going to start have to feel our way through the bean demand, and the idea I'm starting to get is with this large South American crop and our Gulf prices slipping, will we see the beans, you know, falter here because we've priced in a lot of really good demand, but in actuality, the demand coming out of our Gulf is actually going to slip from here on out.
I want to come back to that, but can we stay with wheat for just a second on the world and global ending stocks and the estimates? The numbers there, you said we had a burdensome supply. And when you look at those numbers, there is a very big ending stocks this year compared to last year. It's what, some 30 million metric tons bigger? Is that correct?
That's exactly right, yeah. And you're talking about, I think, something like 50% more than that low crop year of 06 or 07.
And then the production, while up slightly from the March estimate, is down from last year, but still you got to carry in that extra 30 million metric tons. So it seems like wheat could come under pressure as the bulk of the crop will be harvested in this year. So most of it will come in between now and, I don't know, August or October, thereabouts, I would think, because most of the wheat in the world is grown in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah, and I think all that makes sense. I can't argue any of those points. I think the only thing I would say is you've got the crude oil trading near an 18-month high, you've got gold trading near an 18-month high, and you've got the stock market trading near an 18-month high, and yet the world wheat price is trading no better than October of 2009 at the peak of our global recession and our financial crisis. And I think there's a mismatch there, that either the wheat is very, very fairly priced and, in fact, undervalued compared to these outside markets and outside prices for copper and gold and crude oil and stocks, et cetera, or the wheat is going to fall with the outside markets even more. And I think that's why I would put it, as the leader to the upside for the corn, is that it really does have to be the leader for the upside in the corn market. If we're going to bottom in the demand, we should bottom in the demand for wheat. The other thing I like about wheat that really hasn't gotten a lot of attention, and maybe it shouldn't yet, is that we have been seeing wheat purchased by China on the weekly export sales, not big quantities, but quantities nonetheless. And I've always had the mindset that if we start out with China buying anything from the United States other than soybeans, if it's going to be a feed grain, it'll be wheat first and then corn second. So I think in that respect, corn is also a leader.
Is it possible that the burdensome supplies and the reason wheat is not as highly priced, for instance, as crude or corn or soybeans by ratio, is that so much livestock around the globe has gone out of production? And I don't know whether that's the case or not.
I think that may be a contributing factor, but I think the bottom line factor is the reason it's so undervalued is because there's just so much more competition to the wheat in terms of the U.S. wheat.
Okay.
And competition from other countries. I mean, and I'll put it in this perspective, and I'm on the FarmDoc website, so I'm appreciative on live radio to be able to jump to something that quick. But in 2001, we went from an ending stocks of 202 million metric tons down to 167 in 02, down to 131 by 03. I think that's the speed and the rapidity at which the wheat numbers can drop if the demand comes back and we have a little bit of supply hiccups too. And goodness knows, the Ukraine is having some supply hiccups, and China may have some supply hiccups. So I think that's what I'm trying to bring together here is, okay, if these outside markets stay this strong and the buying power and the purchasing power of these big buyers stay together on a good global economy, then we probably are getting to the top end of the wheat supply side if we bring demand back in. And then if we have some supply issues, I mean, in those two crop years, we were able to drop 70 million tons out of the ending stocks globally, and that is a tremendously quick drop.
Okay, now, I didn't leave you a whole lot of time to talk about soybeans, but we have a 190 number. It's lower than the average trade guess. Still, there's an awfully big crop, you suggested, in South America. Suggested, and true. Will beans drop in price?
I think they will, and I think it goes back to the producer and the psychology of the producer, and I've had a lot of discussions the last 2 weeks. I really like hedging for profit here with known risk options, because regardless of whether you're right or wrong, this is a profitable level, and I really like hedging with known risk because there's not going to be any problems with South America at this point. I think we all know that. I mean, the Brazilian crop is ready to be harvested. It's almost all harvested, and if China has any hiccups in terms of weaker demand than expected, I think that's just going to bleed more into our Gulf price. And so while we're still near 940 in November beans, hedge the beans, known risk, and hope they go up against you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great weekend,
hey,
sir.
Hey, you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Joins us from his Lafayette, Indiana office on a Friday afternoon. Dave Dickey will be here in a moment with today's agricultural news.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
Budgeting problems in the state of Illinois have caused University of Illinois Extension to restructure. Gary Beaumont, spokesperson for the service, now joins us. He also happens to be my immediate supervisor. Gary, thank you for being here. What can you tell me about the plan and how soon it will be put into place?
Basically, we're looking at a consolidated administrative structure, closing center offices and staff reductions. This is going to be a long process, so I probably have fewer answers than the questions you have. But one thing I want to state right up front is that in the public meetings that were held last month, it became loud and clear that our clientele appreciated extension programming and wanted a local presence. And the good news in this plan is that extension will maintain a local presence in every county.
They'll have the local presence in every county, but will they always have a local office?
Yes. By local presence, I mean local office. There may be some changes in that in terms of finding cheaper locations, smaller locations, but there will be a local presence.
Tell me the difference between centers and county offices, because I'm not sure that everybody will understand that.
A center is an office where our educators are housed. And these educators have responsibilities across a wider region than just a county. And one change in this new structure is that those center offices will be closed. On June 30th, Carbondale, Effingham, Matson, Macomb, and Mount Vernon centers will be closed. And those educators will actually move to county offices. The remaining center facilities will be closed at the earliest opportunity dependent upon the lease agreement. And those will be our Quad Cities, Rockford, Countryside, East Peoria, Springfield, Champaign, and Edwardsville. Again, the educators who are located there will be moved to county offices.
And those cities all represent, or those are all offices cities that represent centers. And then they will be consolidated into the county structure, but the county structure will also be consolidated.
Well, the administration of the county offices, there will continue to be local programming in every county. But the goal is to have 30 county directors administrating those county programs. And that's fewer than we have now. We have 76 county directors now. So you do the math, and that means 46 positions will disappear. That doesn't mean 46 people will be affected, though, because in anticipating this restructuring, we've held some positions open. Also, extension employees qualify for the voluntary separation program offered by the university, and that will be determined. Staff will be notified by May 3rd if they qualify for that. We're expecting that some of these positions will be, there will be voluntary separation. So we don't know how many people are going to be affected, but we know 46 positions will be affected.
The end result then will be a leaner administrative structure.
Correct.
But a presence, an office in every county of some sort.
Correct.
Educators primarily that are in the centers will move into the county office. So it's a bit of consolidation and a structural change, but extension programming will still be available.
We're hoping to maintain a strong program of extension. What extension is well known for, this high-impact research-based educational programming. We hope to maintain that as much as possible by focusing on the administrative cuts. But we also expect there to be some cuts among civil service staff if there are fewer offices. We expect also there to be fewer regional offices. And there probably will be fewer educators as well.
What's a regional office?
A regional office is a sort of a mid-management position that oversees the personnel issues at the county and center level.
Why did this all come about?
The pressure is from state funding, a decrease in state funding. For instance, Governor Quinn proposed his state budget March 10th. And in that proposed budget, he decreased extension funding $5.59 million out of a total budget of about $65 million. We've been talking about planning for a budget reduction of $4 to $7 million. And just about every week that goes by, that seems to creep up a little bit. It's probably closer to $7 million now, less state funding. So that's been the pressure behind all of these changes.
And finally, there is a timeline with the May 10 date, a May 19 date, and then the dates you gave us in June for closing out some offices. What's May 10 and May 19?
May 10th is the date when the Extension Administration will respond to proposed partnerships between counties. May 3rd is the date when the university will notify employees of acceptance into the voluntary separation program. This is just phase one. We expect that phase two will focus on civil service and educator positions, and phase three will focus on fewer regional administrators.
Who's making the decision about which counties are going together? Is that up to the counties to begin with?
To begin with, they're making a proposal to Extension, and then Extension will approve those or adjust those as they see fit.
That's University of Illinois Extension's Gary Beaumont, and by way of full disclosure, my immediate supervisor, I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to The Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Friday afternoon, time to check the cash grain market. Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois, is with us. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Anybody planting in your region?
Not right here in our area. Field work has been spotty, and it looks like it right around Ludlow, we've been catching all the rain clouds that come over.
Well, they're probably anxious. Have they been calling you then instead?
They are anxious. You can tell just from the tone of the conversations out here. Everybody's ready to go.
And what is the basis like? Because they're ready to go, I suppose they're not hauling.
We are seeing some decent receipt days. It's nice, too wet to get in the field and nothing else to do, and everything's ready. So we are getting some deliveries. 20 end of the May for April basis. So improved from where we have been in the last couple weeks. So we've seen some improvements there.
And you expect that to continue?
Possibly. I mean, there's still a fair chunk of corn to move out there, and exports still are not all that great.
What are your bids for the day?
We are at 326 for nearby corn and 934 on beans.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That is Bruce Bostard. He is the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Friday afternoon. When we return in just 2 minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. State climatologist Jim Angel will be here.
In business news, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that major U.S. banks temporarily lowered their debt levels just before reporting in the past 5 quarters, making it appear their balance sheets were less risky. The paper says today that 18 banks, including Goldman Sachs Group, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, understated the debt levels used to fund securities trades by lowering them an average of 42% at the end of each period. excessive leverage by the banks was one of the causes that led to the global financial crisis in 2008. China's passenger car sales jumped 63% in March from a year earlier, as manufacturers scrambled to meet strong demand driven by tax cuts and government subsidies. Passenger car sales rose to 1.26 million vehicles in March. South Korea's central bank today left its key interest rate at a record low as its new governor begins weighing when to end an 18-month-old easy money plan implemented to help fight the global financial crisis. The Bank of Korea kept its benchmark 7-day repurchase rate at 2%. The bank's Monetary Policy Committee signaled today it has no immediate plans to nudge the rate higher. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. On a Friday afternoon, time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Jim Angel, state climatologist, joins us from the Illinois State Water Survey. Good afternoon to you, Jim.
Good afternoon, Todd.
It was kind of wet and rainy, and it was a bit cold, but sunshine prevails now, at least here in Champaign-Urbana, and it warmed up kind of nicely today.
Yes, it did. It's rather nice out there, and actually we have a pretty nice forecast for the next 4 or 5 days with highs around 70 degrees and lows in the 40s. And right now, there's no forecast for rain in the foreseeable future. I think we're going to see lots of sunshine and some rather warm weather. So that's good news for drying out some of those fields. We're basically dominated by high pressure for the next week or so. And so that's looks like it's going to be pretty favorable conditions.
Do you have a handle on on soil temperatures at the 4-inch level at this time?
Yeah, if you look at soil temperatures around the state, it's about in the mid-50s in most locations, a little warmer to the south naturally, and it's probably a little bit warmer in the areas that are a little bit drier. You know, as you get those wet soils, they're awfully hard to warm up, and I think so those may be still a little on the cold side, but I think we're at least getting into the mid-50s on the soil temperature.
Should be viable for folks to get in to plant as long as it's not too wet and get some germination started, I would think.
I would think so, yes.
Will there be any cold weather that they have to worry about if they do such?
Well, not really. You know, the forecast out for the next several days, the lows are going to be in the 40s, so I don't think we have any risk right now of frost. The average frost date in kind of the central part of the state is around tax day, so about April 15th. It varies quite a bit naturally from year to year. So it'll probably be late April before we can really turn the corner of being safely away from any frost threat. But at least for the next couple of days, it should be fairly warm and unseasonably warm. Our average high for this time of year is around 60. The average low is around 38, so we're running on the warm side.
And can you take a look back, since you're a climatologist, at the month of March and tell me how that one fared?
Yeah, if we look at March, we were a little on the warm side. That kind of reversed the trend of this winter after having 3 below normal months in terms of temperatures. It was actually about 2 and a half degrees above normal for March, slightly below average on the precipitation, too. So those two things together, at least we didn't get any wetter over that period. So we came out of it in pretty good shape.
We appreciate you taking the time with us.
You're welcome.
That is state climatologist Jim Angel. He joined us from the Illinois State Water Survey, and that's located right here in Urbana-Champaign on the University of Illinois campus. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. If you'd like, you can always hear what Jim had to say and much of our other ag programming, actually all of our other ag programming, on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. We'll post Commodity Week, which is our weekend program, to WILLAG.org by about 6 o'clock this evening. You can listen to it before it airs on any of these radio stations. It's all at WILLAG.org. Don't forget to sign up for our weekend newsletter there as well. Just hit subscribe over on the right-hand side of the page. If you don't like it, come back and hit unsubscribe. It's that easy. We try to work for you as much as we can. On behalf of Dave Dickey, your Director of Agricultural Programming from IPM, you have a great afternoon. For some of these radio stations, we'll say goodbye now. For the rest of you, we'll join the farming world, where we'll talk with Joe Persaki from NASS.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
The following program is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're located here on the Land-Grant Institution campus in Urbana-Champaign at the U of I. On the phone line today with us to take a look at how NASS collects data from farmers and all of the types of reports that it produces year in and year out is Joe Persaki. He's in USDA's offices at Washington, D.C. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Todd. Thanks for having me on.
Joe, oftentimes farmers, those who use the data, brokers, look at USDA's stats and say, really, are they backtracking? Are they looking at what they did and did they make a mistake? Are they trying to fix something? Is it a criticism that's accurate?
I don't know if it's a criticism is accurate, but criticism is always good because it always makes you say, oh, hey, what are you doing? You know, should you be doing something different? You know, a lot of the procedures that NASS is doing, at least, you know, one thing we can say is we're consistent. You know, we've been doing things at least, you know, for the acreage surveys and such, we've been doing the same thing for several years so that, you know, people have an idea that we're not doing anything radically different, you know, that we've done in previous years. So, but we do keep abreast of technology changes and such, you know, because like with, say, yields and stuff on corn, you know, we notice when we do our yield surveys that the, plant populations are skyrocketing on corn. And so we look at our models that we run the data through to see, okay, is it making sense, you know, with what we're doing these days? So is the criticism fair? I don't know. I think people are just tough on government these days, just in general.
Well, that may very well be true. So tell me about some of the tougher things that you have to do. I would think that the report that just came out, the March 31 prospective plantings report, is a tough one, but maybe I could be wrong. You collect an awful lot of data. I think something along the lines of 86,000 farmers were surveyed for that particular report.
That's true. I mean, it's 86,000, you know, people. You know, but actually, you know, from a, you know, say a production standpoint or, you know, for us getting the work done, you know, it's really not that, it's not one of the most difficult things we do. Because if you think about it, like on this March intentions, you know, we're asking farmers, what do you intend to plant, you know, this year, your various crops, and then what do you have your stocks? You know, we're just dealing basically with planted area. You know, we're not dealing with harvested area, the relationship between, you know, harvested and planted. We're not dealing with yield and or production in this survey. So, I mean, when you rate things up, is it an important, survey and is it an important release? Sure, it's an important one. You know, but is it difficult for us to, you know, to put together, you know, and get out in a timely manner? It's not the most difficult one we do. I liked the December survey where we've got everything at the end of the season where you've got, you know, planted acreage, you know, harvested area, you know, yield, production, grain stocks, and then we have to get that all ready for that January 12th report. So, I mean, that one's kind of a tough one that we deal with on the crop side of things.
And that would be the end of the year reports. Hey, the other report, and as we move through the month of April and into the growing season, there'll be a weekly report called actually a couple of them, the crop progress report and then the crop weather report that comes out the following day. How do you collect the data for those, and how often is it used?
Right, you know that. You know, actually, that is a those two reports. It's really it's sort of the same report 2 days, a little bit more stuff with it in a second day, you know, because it has some individual state reports and comments in the back. We do the second day's report in joint with the World Board, and the first day is basically our release, you know, with the crop conditions and such. Where we get that information, what we do is we have a cadre of reporters, people that, you know, report on a weekly basis. Who are they? Well, it's local FSA offices, somebody in the FSA offices, extension people, you know, ag extension people, you know they're part of our list. You have various individuals. It could be in some areas it's ag bankers. I mean, so the idea is to get as many people who are knowledgeable about agriculture and can give a fair assessment. When I was in Iowa, I had a regional FSA guy that he every Sunday afternoon he would go take the same trip. He and his wife would take the same trip. Basically, he was doing the route, and then we'd go eat supper. And so he'd take the same route and, you know, send his report. You know, and things. So it's a vast network of individuals helping on that, and it's there's a lot of interest in that report, especially during the growing season when things get going. You know, what percent is planted and where are with emergence and such. And then, you know, like in the harvest season last fall, you know, what percent is harvested. You know, and the snows are coming and such. And there's a lot of interest in that survey.
Is it? Would you call it a windshield survey? I mean,
I would. Yeah, because it's not probability-based. It's basically, you know, it's a very subjective. It's based on those reporters' opinions. This is what they think, you know, what the crop is in their area.
Do you give them guidelines for instance, what a good crop is and what an excellent crop is? I mean, because they're obviously giving you that opinion because that's what you ask them for, but do they have some kind of guidelines to decide what a good corn crop or what a good soybean crop or what an excellent crop might look like or in terms of condition? And I suppose it's condition as opposed to size of the crop, right?
Exactly. It's basically condition, and what we do is it's condition and it's stage. You know, is it emerged, you know, like on corn, wheat, is it heading or is it jointing and that sort of thing. And we do send out at the beginning of every season, we send out, you know, reminder, here's like the instruction. This is what excellent means. This is, you know, what good means and such. And we go through that with them, and then we have those instructions we send them, and then we have teleconferences with our state offices, you know, throughout the country, and then we remind them, you know, what's going on, and then if they have contact with their reporters, you know, just to touch base on that, because you know it's very important, like, to have consistency. But you're exactly right. Is it, you know, is it a rigorous statistical study? No, I would say no. But is it? Does it give you a general feel of where things are with the crops? I would say yes.
All right. So let's move through the season. Those come out on a weekly basis. And then the next thing, really the big thing for those who are corn and soybean producers and that comes out for the Midwest, would be the June acreage report. And that would be an actual statistical update of what the prospective plantings report that was released in March would have been. How often does it change, and how is the data collection different on the two?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So there's a couple questions you had there. You know, how does it change, and how is it different than what we do? In June, there's really two surveys we do. Okay. We'll compare and contrast it with March. In March, we just do one survey. It's a farmer survey. It's phone, mail, personal interview, internet response. Okay. So that's that. In June, we have two components. One is the farmer survey that we ask people, you know, how many acres of corn, say, did you plant or intend to plant, because in case it's late, and then how many acres do you intend to harvest? So we get a first snapshot of harvested area, corn and beans. We ask the farmers what they did. And in addition to that, we also have another survey that we call our June area survey that we actually send enumerators out to they're roughly 1 mile square piece of land. We call them segments, you know, segments of land. They're roughly 1 mile square, 640 acres. And our enumerators, they basically canvass those segments, those 1 mile square piece of land, identifying what's in every field. You know, is it corn? Is it hay? Is it trees? Is there a railroad track going through there? Is there power lines? And, you know, so that gives us, you know, like ground truth, basically, what's going on. And then we have the other survey, the farmer opinion survey, or well, the farmer survey, the farmer reported survey, where the acres are. So that, you know, together that goes into our June acreage report. And then there's also a stocks portion of that as well. We're asking farmers what amount of grain they still have stored on their farm. So it's different, in fact, than March, that we have two pieces. We have the farmer survey, and then we have the area survey we actually visit. And it's interesting. It seems like it's compressed time. A lot of farmers are still, you know, seeding beans and stuff at that time, so it's, sometimes it's kind of tough to track them down. But, you know, we get them. So that's an important survey, too. That's, like you said, that's the next one in the progression, yeah.
Yeah, how often does that number change dramatically? And I don't know what I would define as dramatically yet from the March number.
Yeah, what do you mean dramatically? Last year, we had about a 3.5 million acre increase in overall principal crops from March to June. I mean, is that a dramatic change? Overall, I mean, you know, from March to the final survey, it's usually within, you know, 2.5 to 3%. I mean, if you go back over time the last 15 years, it's fairly close. So sometimes there's changes, you know, from, you know, March to June, and it depends. I mean, you could have a situation where, you know, people intend to plant corn, and maybe they don't have all their chemicals down and it starts raining. What do you do? Well, they switch to beans. Or in Illinois, especially down south, you know, they've already got the chemicals in, it's raining. Well, they'll maybe switch from corn to grain sorghum. You know, so, I mean, so there is some switching, and it all basically depends on weather, really, on that. Because by the time June comes around, you know, people know what they're going to do unless you have some sort of weather event.
And then take me through one final event. When do you actually, and when normally, and last year wasn't a normal year, but when do you actually start to get real statistical data on the size of the crop? Not the first time you take a look at it, but when you get real stats.
Okay. Well, we start looking at, you know, acreage, you know, that was through June. And then the next time we get a snapshot on acreage would be in October for corn bean guys. Because by then, you know, FSA, you know, their certified planted area is in pretty good shape. By what I mean by that is that, you know, farmers have to sign up, what is it, mid-June, you know, there in Illinois, I believe. Isn't it? I think it's June 15th. And that data are not available by a push button. I mean, there's still counties that are putting it in by hand. But by the time we get to that late September, first part of October, we've got a really good handle on the size of the area planted. So there'll be an acreage update there. But then when we start talking about yield, okay, the first time we start doing something with yield on corn from a survey base is August. And we continue that August, September, October, November. And then our final is going to be in January. So that's just kind of a rough snapshot there. Now, as you know, people say, well, you know, how close or how accurate you are? Well, the further you get into the growing season, you know, the closer to maturity, the better job we do on forecasting the size of the crop. That's because, and when I tell people, well, there's really components to crops. I mean, you know how many acres are planted, how many acres are harvested. Okay, well, now, of that acres, well, how many ears on corn are you going to get per acre, and then how much is each ear going to weigh? Well, I can give you a really good measure on how many ears are going to be fairly early in the season, but it's all about that, how much is each ear going to weigh. And by the time we get to October, we start taking, you know, field, we start pulling stuff out of the field and send it to the labs, we start getting a real good handle on what that size of that crop's going to be.
Joe, we appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Sure, Todd. Thanks a lot. And I want to thank all the farmers out there that do take the time to fill out reports, you know, because it's them. They're the ones that provide us with that raw material, that data that we end up compiling and sending it out and having it available for everyone.
Joe Persaki is the director of the Statistics Division of USDA's National Agricultural Service. Joined us from his Washington, D.C. office. I'm Todd Gleason. This program is a production of Illinois Public Media.
It's National Chinese Almond Cookie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1682, Robert de La Salle discovered the mouth of the Mississippi River and claimed the whole Mississippi Basin for France. He named it Louisiana in honor of Louis XIV of France. LaSalle returned to the New World 2 years later with intent to establish a French colony on the Gulf of Mexico at the mouth of the Mississippi. But the expedition was plagued by pirates and poor navigation, landing on what today is Victoria, Texas. LaSalle never saw the Mississippi again. Three attempts to find it on foot failed, and LaSalle was eventually murdered by one of just 36 colonists remaining from the original 300 making the trip. In 1850, William Prout died, an English chemist. He was the first to classify food components into three main divisions: carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. In 1872, Samuel R. Percy of New York received a patent for dried milk. In 1894, R.H. Gray received a patent for a baling press. And in 1922, Sir Patrick Manson died. Manson co-founded a dairy farm in 1886 in Hong Kong, which looked to improve health by supplying cows milk free of contamination by means of stringent hygiene. And that's this day in agricultural history.
The Farming World is a production of Illinois Public Media. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for our program, please do drop us a line. You can call me at 217-333-9697 or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. Again, the phone number 217-333-9697 or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. We're interested in knowing what you'd like to hear on the next edition of The Farming World.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to The Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In the second part of our program today, we're going to preview this Sunday's Vet Med Open House. Third-year vet student Heidi Dinelli is with us. Thanks for taking the time, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
How are you involved in the open house this weekend?
I'm a third-year student on the committee, and what the committee does, there's about 16 of us, and we oversee all of the vet students and make sure everyone has all their booths set up and all their exhibits set up, and just basically organize it for all the students.
What kinds of things that people come to the Vet Med Open House will they see?
I'd say our number one exhibit is the fistulated cow, which is a cow with a hole in its stomach. So you can actually reach in and feel the inside of a cow's stomach. And the cow's perfectly fine. It's safe, and people really seem to enjoy it. We also have a bunch of reptiles that people can come and see, and baby pigs and sheep and goats. The police force actually comes out and does a demo, too. So there's tons of things. There's a kids' tent for all the kids to come and make little animal ears, and it's a lot of fun for everyone. So.
When is it?
It is this Sunday, April 11th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
And who do you think will come out to the show? Who generally comes out to the show, and should VetMed prospective students come and see you?
Yeah, generally we have a bunch of families, or we have a lot of schools take field trips and bring all their students. And then we also do have prospective students. There's going to be a couple of admissions question-answer sessions, and we have an admissions booth, so prospective students really enjoy that and learn a lot. So basically, it's for everyone just to come out and see what VetMed's all about and see what we're up to nowadays and just learn a little bit more about the profession and about what we do here.
You talked about the fistulated cow. Some people may not know what that is.
Yes.
What is it?
Basically, it's a cow that our instructors and veterinarians have taken and basically made a hole in its stomach so you can reach your hand inside of it and just see what goes on inside the cow's stomach. Because basically cows have four stomachs and they have a huge rumen, which if you put a hole in at the top, nothing comes out and you can actually see what's going on in there and see all the hay and the grass that the cow eats. So it's pretty cool to see the inside of a cow.
Do we still do research with the fistulated cows?
Yes, they do. I believe they take samples from them and do different studies using the fistulated technique. I'm not sure what exact studies are going on right now, but they do.
Now, Heidi, you're involved with the overall view of this. Will you be operating one of the exhibits or demos as well?
No, as a part of the committee, I will be overseeing all of the events. So we have different jobs, like being at welcome tents and making sure people know where exhibits are, and then making sure all our students are doing okay with their exhibits, and basically overseeing the entire event.
Have you seen the police dog demo yet?
No, I haven't. I really want to because I heard it's really neat. So,
what kinds of things do they do?
I've heard that they show like what the dogs do and how they respond to commands, but I haven't seen it myself. But it seems pretty cool, and you can also ask tons of questions. They're really open to questions. So
one of the other things that I think tends to be very popular is it's possible to come out and milk a cow.
Yes, that is still possible. So students, especially like students from the city who haven't, you know, been around cows, can come in, and our vet students will help them milk a real actual cow. So that's pretty cool.
Again, when is the Vet Med open house and what times does it run?
It's this Sunday, April 11th, and it's from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you.
Heidi Dinelli is a third-year vet student, and she is involved with the Vet Med open house that is this coming Sunday. You've, of course, been listening to The Farming World. We do invite you here to campus for Vet Med open house on Sunday. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a great afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
The Farming World is a production of Illinois Public Media. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for our program, please do drop us a line. You can call me at 217-333-9697 or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. Again, the phone number, 217-333-9697 or email to tgleason@illinois.edu. We're interested in knowing what you'd like to hear on the next edition of The Farming World.